Media versus Northland Cable?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good. Okay, we'll take that argument. Second. Good morning. This is Division 3 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We're here to hear two arguments, one in case 2009 CA 799, Hunter versus Mansell, which will go first, and 2008 Court of Appeals 1151 and 2008 Colorado Appeals 2474, Green River Media versus Northland Cable. Those are apparently consolidated on appeal. Let me make a brief record. Both arguments are set for 15 minutes per side. The parties may use the time any way they wish. You can come, it doesn't make any difference to us how you use it. However, you should be aware that we've all read the briefs. We've read some of the authority cited in the briefs. We think we understand the general nature of the case, the facts, and the general principles of law. In addition, one of us has been into the record to some considerable extent. So we would suggest you go immediately to questions of law, the legal argument, and assume, if you would, that we know most of the facts as set forth in the papers. The appellant may, of course, reserve time for rebuttal, although this is a rather unusual case in that regard, and we'll get to that in a moment. And if you want assistance doing that, you may, and you may have rebuttal time too on your cross appeal. If you want to reserve time for rebuttal, please let me know and I'll try to be of some assistance in that. The arguments are timed with a digital timer. There's a module on the lectern which will be a reverse countdown of your time in any event, so it will advise you of how much time is remaining. The light will be green during the first 10 minutes of the argument, yellow or orange in the second, next 5 minutes, and red when the argument's over. The lectern is adjustable for height with toggle switches that will be on your right, one for up and one for down. If you find it uncomfortably high or low, please feel free to adjust it. There's a microphone on the lectern, the purpose of which is, I think, twofold. One, to amplify the sound in the room, and two, to record the argument. We frequently use recordings in the preparation of the opinion or in review, later review of the argument if some confusion arises in that regard. So we'd like you to stay next to the lectern or near the lectern so we can pick up your voice clearly. We would ask that anyone, and that includes the people on the bench, has an electronic device, a pager, a phone, whatever it is, please turn it off or put it on silent. And if you need to respond to it in some fashion, please leave the room before doing so, so as not to disturb either the court or counsel in the conversation in which we are about to engage. With respect to the first case, logically, it seems to me the first issue that needs to be addressed is whether there was an adverse possession or not, and what the title is, or is that agreed to, that the adverse possession is not complete or is complete? And then the second question is, what's the remedy if Ms. Mansell is trespassing? Is that the, I mean, I'm just wondering who should go first, logically.
Your Honor, I'm Tom Walsh, appearing on behalf of Ms. Mansell, if I may address that issue. And I intended to address it first out at the gate when I began my argument. It's Ms. Mansell's position that she's satisfied with the ruling the trial court has made as it currently stands. But
with respect to ownership?
With respect, well, no, Your Honor. She believes that the court improperly, as is the basis of our cross appeal, she believes that the court, trial court, improperly dismissed her claim for adverse possession.
Properly?
Improperly dismissed her claim for adverse possession, and she believes she's entitled to a trial on the merits on that issue. But if the court is inclined to deny Ms. Hunter's appeal and leave standing the order requiring Ms. Hunter to sell the property, the property's already been appraised. She would prefer that because it's going to be much less expensive just to follow through with the court's current order, which would transfer title to her also. So I understand the court's point, And what I was going to argue is that I think the court must first address whether there's error in the court's final determination with the subject of Ms. Hunter's appeal, the denial of the mandatory injunction. And then if the court is inclined to grant that, on remand, the court has to address the cross appeal, which is whether the court should reinstate the claim for adverse possession.
Thank you. Are you in substantial agreement with that?
Agreement that, or not an agreement, but a strong opinion that there was no basis for finding adverse possession and the court's finding in summary judgment that my claim is correct. And given that finding, I think it's black and white left law.
Well, we're not going to argue now. I just wanted to know. Go ahead. Do you want to reserve time for rebuttal?
I'll try to reserve it, but I won't ask the court to.
Do you want to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I will.
Do you have monitored that yourself?
No,
okay. We're ready to proceed, sir.
May it please the court, my name is Victor Boog. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mrs. Betty Hunter. As the court knows, there are two legal issues raised by Ms. Hunter on appeal. First, did the court err in denying Ms. Hunter mandatory injunctive relief requiring removal of encroachments upon her property? And second, did the court err by ordering Ms. Hunter to execute and deliver to the appellee, Ms. Mansell, a deed to 1,381 square feet of Ms. Hunter's property upon payment of its appraised value? These rulings by the court were preceded by summary judgment in favor of Ms. Hunter that the claim of adverse possession by Ms. Mansell had no merit. It was granted on summary judgment for a very simple reason. Both Ms. Hunter and the former owner of the property, Ms. Jean Johnson, had sworn statements submitted in support of the motion for summary judgment that the pole barn or shed, which was encroaching on Ms. Hunter's property, was put there inadvertently over the property line, and that there had been an agreement between these parties way back in the 70s that this pole barn would be permitted to remain as long as the Johnsons owned the property.
I appreciate that agreement is in the record in the form of affidavits. However, the trial court ruled that the disclosures made by Ms. Johnson in the sale of the property constituted a waiver or abandonment of any title she may have obtained by adverse possession.
As this court knows and has ruled many times, when a trial court has evidence before it that supports its decision, but it doesn't rely on that and bases the decision on something else, that the decision will be upheld.
Okay,
and
well,
here,
that's not what you said. You said the court granted it based upon the affidavits, but let
no,
me back
I
up.
Said there was evidence in the record to support what the court did, whether it used it or not.
Let me back up a minute. Are you conceding that the basis upon which the trial court granted the summary judgment was wrong?
No.
Okay.
I think there was multiple reasons to grant summary judgment. The main one was there wasn't a single counter affidavit submitted by Ms. Mansell to challenge the request for summary judgment made by my client.
Counsel, can I take one hopefully just half a minute? I thought in the answer brief they claimed that the judge did not consider either the owner's or the seller's affidavit at the summary judgment stage. Is that correct?
The court did not rely upon the sworn statement of Ms. Johnson. Instead, it relied upon all the disclosures made by Ms. Johnson as part of the purchase of the property by Ms. Mansell in 2001.
Did the court say it would not consider the affidavit of Ms. Johnson?
I don't know that the court ever said that on summary judgment. If it's in the record, I'm bound by it. But I think the court just said there's a multitude of reasons why I'm going to grant summary judgment here, and he didn't rely upon Ms. Johnson's affidavit.
Counsel, since this court reviews summary judgment de novo,
right,
what difference does it make what the trial court did?
I don't think it makes any difference as long as there's support in the record for the summary judgment entered. That's my point to begin with. The irony is that this case is a very much like the case of Steiger versus Burroughs, cited in the briefs. In that case, a woman who was deceased as of the time of trial got permission to build a house on somebody else's property. with the understanding that once she's gone, she has no right to the underlying land. And in that case, at trial, it turns out that as part of the will of this deceased person who had built this house on somebody else's property, she acknowledged in writing that she had no claim to the underlying land. That's not much different from what happened here. And in the Steigers case, the answer was, you don't have any right to the land, you can't force the landowner to buy your house and remove it. And that's what I think the law is in this case. This encroachment, which started out as a very modest pole shed, after the property was purchased by Ms. Mansell, she goes ahead with full knowledge that this is an encroachment and puts in a concrete floor in this very modest structure, reinforces it structurally, paints it, puts in electricity, and then says, gee, I'm an innocent person here. She was anything but an innocent person. And given that there is a basis in the record to support the trial court's grant of summary judgment, even if it wasn't for the reasons that the court said, the ruling on what is a continuing trespass, the law on continuing trespass is black and white. It can be abated, and as long as it continues, it results in an existing causes of action which continue into the future. That's important for a couple of reasons. One, it doesn't allow you to get future damages. Here, the judge not only finds that there's a continuing trespass, which by its very nature, as opposed to a permanent trespass, can be abated. He then says, but I'm going to grant Ms. Hunter relief she never asked for, $1 a month for as long as this continuing trespass continues. Well, you can imagine the shock on my client's face when she's told she's going to get $1 a month for this encroachment that she didn't want there in the first place. Then when the judge denied us mandatory injunctive relief because the court thought it was an extraordinary remedy, when in fact the cases show that it is the remedy, because when you have a continuing trespass, the law is that going forward day by day or week by week and bringing additional claims is not an adequate legal remedy. And instead, the court then, at the end of the court's ruling from the bench, was to be put into paper form and signed. I suggested to the court that I wanted a confirmation that even though the court wasn't going to grant us mandatory injunctive relief, my client had a right to self-help to remove this encroachment from her property. And the court got a little concerned about that and said, maybe we better brief that. We shouldn't start a new lawsuit before we finish the first one. And so we fully briefed that. And then the court said, I found this case from New Jersey in which a court exercised its equitable powers and said, we're just going to have Ms. Mansell, we're going to have her have the right to purchase this property. Property, by the way, that included 1,381 square feet that Ms. Mansell never and her predecessors never had exclusive use to in the first place. The pole barn footprint was a far cry and a lot smaller portion of ground than the 1,381 square feet.
That was one of my questions. How did this 300-square-foot encroachment, and I've been in the record, so I've seen the survey, 300-square-foot encroachment become 1,100 to 1,400 square feet?
Because Ms. Mansell decided that she'd just like to have additional property next to her property because it was on the plateau above the hillside, and it would be much more beneficial to her than my client. That was the only basis, because it was not enclosed by a fence. That is the record evidence. When you look at that survey, you see a little bit of a straggly fence that just sort of goes out the middle of nowhere and stops. It was not enclosed ground. It was not ground that Ms. Mansell had ever used.
Somebody apparently put some improvements on it.
Not on this 1,381 square feet. This is just
there's a sidewalk or something, a pathway, some sort of stone wall, and this fence.
Out at the highway, there's a stone wall, a significant stone wall that follows the true recorded and surveyed property line. After that, it just sort of, this historically somebody put a little bit of dirt out there, filled dirt, put some rocks in there so it wouldn't tumble down the hill, and it just sort of meandered out to nowhere.
Okay, let me ask you another question. These additional improvements, were they necessary to the use of the barn or the bull shed at all?
Absolutely not. But Ms. Mansell wanted a structure that she could store things in and make sure that it was weather tight. This old pole barn was just an old pole barn. It had metal sides. The wind blew, the snow came in. It was just a shed, if you will.
Is there any, in the $9,000 estimated cost for removing the improvements, did that include anything other than a pole barn?
To my knowledge, Ms. Mansell had gotten an estimate of what it might cost to move this shed, this pole barn, and somebody apparently told her that's what they would do it for, and that's all that was involved,
okay,
to my knowledge.
The shed itself.
Yeah. Now, would it have cost $9,000 to remove this shed before she put in a concrete floor and did all these other things? I doubt it. The shed itself wouldn't have been.
Is there any evidence in the record? Because we don't have the transcript of that hearing.
Of the, preliminary injunction hearing?
I don't recall ever seeing the transcript in the record.
The record should include not only the trial on the mandatory injunctive relief request, but also the preliminary injunction hearing as well.
I've not seen any transcripts. I'll take another look, but I've not seen any transcripts.
Well, maybe it's because they're on a disk.
Well, they may be on a disk. They're not on e-file. They're not on e-file. And there are no indications in the record that they're anything other than e-file.
Well, in my statement of facts in my brief, I've cited to the record transcript pages all over the place. So I had a transcript, and I got it as part of the record on appeal.
Okay, we'll take another look.
Anyhow, this 1,381 square feet, Ms. Mansell just said, I'd like the line to go way out here. In an area where she'd never really, not only hadn't exercised exclusive use, she hadn't used it at all.
It's not a question of exclusive use because the adverse possession claim is gone. The question is it necessary and convenient, I guess? I don't know. What standard do we use if we give her more than 300 square feet?
There's no basis for it whatsoever.
No basis for more than 300 square feet?
None.
Okay.
There's no evidence that the additional 1,081 square feet was used by her?
No, there's none. She just decided that she wanted more of that hilltop, and that she just drew a line and said, that's what I want. It was never enclosed. It was never exclusively in the Johnsons' possession, much less Ms. Mansell's possession. And it was an area where my client's handyman was up there all the time, cutting shrubs and cutting down old Siberian elms. In fact, they wanted a injunctive relief precluding my client from going up there and cleaning the brush off this hillside. There was a fire hazard. They didn't get it.
You have about 2 minutes, 30-some seconds left.
I'd like to reserve the rest of my argument, but to me, when you have a continuing trespass like here, you're entitled to mandatory injunctive relief, and you're certainly not. They wouldn't have a right to condemn this property under Article 2, Section 14 of the Colorado Constitution. But that's essentially what happens now. Under the judge's ruling, you must sell your property to this person. There's no basis for that in any Colorado case law whatsoever. That's why he went to New Jersey. Improperly, I submit.
Thank you, counsel. You have about a minute, 57 seconds.
Good morning. For the police of the court, my name is Tom Walsh. I represent the appellee in this case and cross-appellant, Alana Mansell. I'd like to start with the issue that was raised before argument began regarding what my client seeks in this appeal. As I tried to explain before to the court, the current order, which requires the sale by Ms. Hunter to Mansell of the property dispute, is satisfactory to my client. Property has been appraised. It's a few thousand dollars.
Is it appraised at $2,000?
I don't remember the exact number. A few thousand is what I said, and I honestly don't recall if it was two or three or four.
Is that the 300 or the 1,300 square feet?
The 1,300 square feet. I believe it was appraised at about $2 a square foot, I believe, but I, again, I apologize, I don't recall exactly.
Let's pick up where we left off. What's the basis for having an encroachment over 300 square feet?
Well, Your Honor, I didn't try the underlying case, so I'm probably possibly not as familiar with the record as Mr. Boog, but at the top of page 2 of the court's findings of facts, conclusions of law, the ones that were dated January 6 and entered sometime thereafter, it's on the record at page 244. The court discusses the boundary survey plat, discusses the garage, which Mr. Boog calls a pole barn, and it's in the order reads, it also, referring to the boundary survey, it also reflects the existence of a row of junipers and a wire fence on a rock wall as being located on the Hunter property. The total area of encroachment is approximately 1,200 square feet. So 1,200 square feet is the court's determination of what the encroachment is from Ms. Mansell's property, Ms. Mansell's encroachment on Ms. Hunter's property. And the court should also note that upon motion of Ms. Mansell, the trial court visited the property, observed the property himself, saw what's there, and what he deemed, obviously, he ultimately deemed was appropriate in ordering Ms. Hunter to sell.
He's already ruled against adverse possession. All we have is a trespass. How, and you're saying, under the court's remedy, Ms. Hunter has to sell whatever Ms. Mansell thinks would be useful for her.
No, whatever the court, the trial court, it's not what Ms.
Well, what the court, trial court thinks is useful.
No, what the trial court deemed would be appropriate under equitable circumstances. The trial court went out there and looked at this property, Your Honor, but there's this huge, steep drop off. We're talking about basically the top of an inaccessible area from Ms. Hunter's property that you have to basically climb up on all fours.
What does this have to do with remedying a trespass?
Well, Your Honor, I think it addresses the issue that Mr. Boog raised at the conclusion of the trial, as I read the transcript, which was the trial court said, I'm entering an order for $1 a month in damages, nominal damages, because I find that there's been a trespass and I find there's been no damages, so I'm awarding nominal damages of $1 a month. And then as I read the record, Mr. Boog said, well, what about self-help? My client will go out there and just, you know, self-help remedy. And the court said, submit briefs on that, which they did. And the trial court said, rather than have Ms. Hunter trespass on Ms. Mansell's property, damage Ms. Mansell's property, and so this kind of self-help, I believe in my powers as an equitable court imposing an equitable remedy, I'm going to require Ms. Hunter to transfer this very, very small portion of her property to Ms. Mansell at a price determined by a neutral.
And this is supposed to remedy a trespass of the pole barn?
It's supposed to solve the problem before the court, Your Honor, which is this problem with this boundary line that's been encroached upon, and there's no damage.
Let me understand correctly. If I own a piece of property in the mountains where the boundaries are a little fuzzy, and somebody encroaches on my land, the Court of Equity is going to require me to sell part of my land to the encroacher. Is that what you think the remedy ought to be?
Not in every circumstance.
Well, what's unique about this circumstance?
What's unique about this circumstance, Your Honor, is that there was no evidence of damages.
Does there have to be for a trespass?
No, there does not. But there has to be some injury in order for there to be injunction.
Isn't the injury presumed?
Taking my property an injury?
Not if you present no evidence of what the injury is.
Well, isn't the existence of the pole barn on my property by its very nature injury?
That was not an argument presented to the trial court, and there was no evidence of that.
It's not an injury to your property interests?
No, Your Honor. And again, this is where the visit
you're having your pole on my property is not an injury to my property interest.
Well, absence any evidence of whether it's an injury,
what
no.
Does it have to be? That's why we have equity to some extent. Can't prove damage. Now, the damage here is the loss of a few square feet on the backside of a piece of property. Now, if the court can require the owner to sell, isn't it encouraging trespass?
No, Your Honor, because in this case, there's no evidence that this was an intentional trespass. That doesn't have
now,
to
there
be.
There is evidence that Ms. Mansell installed substantial improvements on this building on notice that it encroached.
Correct.
And the court found she was not in bad faith
because
and did not act maliciously, but she was not innocent.
But
and there's no finding she acted in good faith.
There is finding that she had a reasonable belief that that was her property that she purchased from Ms. Johnson.
But that was after this. I understood that the evidence is, and I haven't read the record, Counselor, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I understood that some of the improvements made to the shed was after the grant of the summary judgment.
I can't speak to that, Your Honor. I know that there were some improvements to the patio, which is also an issue after the grant of summary judgment, putting down some slate. I apologize. I'm not certain whether there's improvements to the.
Was there any evidence presented as to what it would have cost to remove or move the pole shed prior to the improvements that your client made?
Not that I'm aware of.
And is not it your burden to prove that?
No, Your Honor. I don't know why.
The court determined that the other property owner had to sell because of the extraordinary cost that it would be to remove the shed.
That is part of the consideration, yes.
And did you not present evidence of what it would cost to remove the shed in its present condition?
There was testimony that would cost $9,000 in the condition of the shed, and I can't address the court's question whether that's before or after the summary judgment was entered. But if I may address the injury question, the damages question on the trespass, the court again has to understand. This court needs to understand the unique circumstances. The trial court went through in its order the various measures of damages that the court could impose in a trespass action: diminution of value, injury, all these things, and found that when none of those things existed, there was no evidence of any of those things. The question was, isn't the mere existence of the pole on my property damages? Under the circumstance of this
injury.
I apologize. And under the circumstance of this case, I would suggest to you the court has found no. This is a little corner of the property of this huge hill. You can't even see it from Ms. Hunter's property until she climbs up around and has to trespass to find this corner that's been there for decades.
So the fact is that I can make better use of your property than you can gives me a property interest in your property.
No, but it doesn't give me a right to tear down your property at the expense of mine. This is a garage.
It gives you the right to condemn my property by paying fair market value.
My client to condemn it?
It gives you a right to condemn Ms. Hunter's property by the payment of the fair market value, which makes her tantamount to the government, because the government's the only one I know that can do that.
Is the court, in acting as a court of equity, the right to impose that remedy if it sees fit.
And didn't one case decided by division of this court at least suggest that that was not a right the court could exercise?
Your Honor, that was, yes, FDIC versus Myers, but that case is distinguishable from this case. Number one, it was not a case of trespass. It was not a case.
Well, it was a case of trespass after the consent was withdrawn.
Well, I don't believe a claim of trespass was ever brought. It was a quiet title action because if I'm remembering the case correctly, it's one where the title to the improvements was held separately than the title to the ground.
Right. And after the circumstances arose and consent to have the buildings occupied the ground was withdrawn, the buildings became a trespass. Did it not? Is that not what the court said?
I could review the decision, Your Honor, but the case was primarily about this issue of whether the court could force the sale of the entire property and then force the parties to split the proceeds of the sale based on the valuation of the building versus the property.
Did the division cite the restatement that said that once consent is withdrawn, you only have a reasonable time to remove because it's a trespass?
Yes, and that is the law. Don't dispute that, Your Honor. And that relates to the issue on Ms. Hunter's appeal that somehow she has this absolute right to a mandatory injunction in these circumstances, and that is not the law. The court mandatory injunction
is certainly the premier remedy.
Premier remedy?
It's certainly the premier remedy, is it not? I mean, the exceptions are rare.
Well, all the cases cited by Ms. Hunter in her brief, there's express and real injury to the property, and the court finds that under those circumstances, a mandatory injunction is appropriate. There, none of those cases say that it's mandatory, kind of an interesting turn of phrase, but the mandatory injunction is required of the trial court. The trial court has to exercise that as the sole remedy. None of the cases hold that.
Did the trial court here impose a mandatory injunction upon the owner of the property?
Effectively, I would argue yes. It's as part of its equitable remedy to resolve the situation. And there's also a Supreme Court case, Your Honor, that was cited by the trial court, which is Golden Press versus Rylands, where the Supreme Court said the court is not required where the footers of the building encroached on the other. And the court did not require permanent injunction. So while it is true there are many, many cases
that's
where
the most extreme case in the books that I've read.
And this is
an encroachment over a 160-foot masonry wall of 2 inches, 7 feet underground. And the owner of the encroached upon property would not permit the owner of the adjacent property to come in on his property and remove the 2 inches from the footing. And the court said, we're not going to make them remove it.
Well,
the wall and remove it.
The encroached upon party, the Hunter party, wouldn't allow them to come in jackhammer it down. They wanted a mandatory injunction requiring them to remove the whole wall. So they were going to allow them on the property to remove the whole wall. But as I read the opinion, it was they wouldn't allow them to go in there and jackhammer it. And Your Honor, I agree. It is the most extreme example. But I would suggest to you that the trial court, which visited this property, which listened to the testimony, which reviewed all the facts, is in a better position than this court to determine that this case is similar and to Golden Press and the remedy imposed in Golden Press, or at least the denial of the mandatory injunction was appropriate. That the standard of review of this court is abuse of discretion for both the issues upon which Ms. Hunter seeks an appeal. And given the fact that this determination, that specifically the denial of the mandatory injunction is so fact-based, I think this court is hard-pressed to determine that the trial court has abused its discretion in applying the standards set forth in Golden Press. So my client's position is that the denial of the mandatory injunction is appropriate, and that the award of the sale of the property is appropriate. But the court could determine the sale is not appropriate, ordering the sale is not appropriate, but the denial of the mandatory injunction is, which puts us back at the court's order of nominal damages of $1 a month. And my client is happy
well,
with
and
that.
What are the terms of this leasehold that under that dollar a month? What is a breach, and what are the remedies on breach? Can Ms. Mansell expand her use of the property under this leasehold and build another building on the 1,400 square feet? What are the terms?
I don't know that the court determined those. The court said that
the court have an obligation, and it isn't the court in a very bad position to do so.
Well, if Your Honor is suggesting that the case be remanded for further determinations of the terms of that leasehold, we wouldn't necessarily dispute that. But we don't want that.
Under a minute. You want to reverb rebuttal?
Sure, Your Honor. Okay. Please. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Federal Deposit Insurance Corp. versus Mars case is indeed on all fours, as I think Judge Criswell has already concluded. In addition, the Golden Press versus Rylands case, as Judge Roy has indicated, was really a question of unconscionability, and that word is used in that decision. I mean, it was an outrage what was going on in that case. And that's why the court was not going to be a party to basically extortion when there was 2 inches, 7 feet below the ground that somebody wanted to remove, but wouldn't allow anybody to come on their property to do so. I think where Judge Berryhill got off track in this case was that he started with the Golden Press Rylands case and decided that mandatory injunctive relief was an extraordinary remedy. And then he went from that all the way to New Jersey, which apparently has different laws than this court, this jurisdiction has with respect to the remedies permitted. Here, a continuing trespass is exactly that. You don't give somebody future damages because the cause of action accrues daily as the continuation of the trespass, as the trespass continues. So the idea that $1 per month in perpetuity or forever was an improper decision in the first place, and it only got complicated when the judge thereafter said, well, instead of that, you just have to sell your property to this lady, especially when this lady was anything but innocent. And I look at this New Jersey case and talks about innocence. There's no innocence here at all. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Do you have anything you want to add, sir?
Briefly.
Your Honor, if this court determines that the order requiring sale is improper and it needs to be reversed, and this court determines that the order denying the permanent injunction, mandatory injunction, is improper, then Ms. Mansell's cross appeal is asking the court to reverse the trial court's grant of summary judgment. And there was some discussion of that in the other argument. The letter signed by Ms. Johnson, based in 2002, that the trial court did not consider in summary judgment and barred from the trial, is Exhibit F. It's on the record, page 88. It was notarized.
If the trial court didn't consider it, doesn't mean we can't consider it in view of the fact that this is a de novo review, isn't it?
Agreed, Your Honor, but the trial court determined that it was disputed. And trial court, and this court should also find it's disputed. It was executed.
With what? Disputed with what? Evidence.
On its face. Because it's notarized a month after it's allegedly written by a woman who's deceased, and done a year after the sale took place. It's just a very questionable document.
So you're saying confidence, and not really that it's disputed.
Well, and the other documents that were presented in response that were executed by Ms. Johnson a year prior to this document at the time of the sale that contradict the terms of this. In other words, there's disputed evidence.
Okay.
Summary judgment wasn't appropriate, and that's why the court didn't enter summary judgment on the grounds argued by Ms. Hunter, but on a different grounds. And I've addressed that in my brief while we think the grounds.
Was there a dispute with respect to the other affidavit?
It was the affidavit of Ms. Hunter's self-serving affidavit saying that that's my property and I never gave permission to use it. I don't. If the terms of this affidavit are in dispute and the documents that Ms. Johnson are in dispute, then the facts in Ms. Hunter's affidavit that corroborate this are also in dispute. That would be our position.
All right.
Was there any evidence presented that there had been no informal agreement a few years after the building of this shed?
Your Honor, in my reply brief, the last brief filed, I go through the documents that were presented, signed by Ms. Johnson at the time of the closing, that where she said there are no unwritten agreements regarding this property. There's no encroachments. I don't have the brief in front of me, but it's all the evidence is set forth in the reply.
Right, and that's all concerns the transaction between Ms. Johnson and Ms. Mansell. But is there anything to dispute the nature of the agreement between the owner and Ms. Johnson?
Ms. Hunter and Ms. Johnson.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor, because these documents that Ms. Johnson executed at the time that she conveyed the property to Ms. Mansell affirmatively attested the fact that there were no unwritten agreements pertaining to the use of this property.
But that didn't refer to the property that is in dispute, did it?
Yes, it did.
Was that conveyed?
Yes. Our position would be
by what deed was it conveyed?
There's two issues, Your Honor. There's the building itself, which was part of the property, which encroaches, and there's the I correct myself, Your Honor. It was not conveyed by deed, conveyed by possession. It was identified in this encroachment. That's what Ms. Hunter relies on, and the court ultimately relied on in saying there was this a disclaimer. It was actually Ms. Johnson's acknowledgement that there's a disputed portion of this property that's in dispute with Ms. Hunter. And it's set forth in the brief, Your Honor. Our position is the court doesn't need to address that unless it grants Ms. Hunter's appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We want to thank both counsel. You got time left? I want to thank both counsel for their arguments and their briefs. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. Thank you, sir. Sirs.